Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good afternoon. I'm still reporting on national security. Newly released emails of Hillary Clinton show that as Secretary of State, she repeatedly originated and distributed highly classified national security information in direct violation of law. Experts sifting through the thousands of printed pages of emails recently released have already discovered scores of classified emails. Copies of some of these emails have just been released, showing in some cases that the information contained in the emails was so classified that all of the text has been erased or redacted, except for the classification codes. These codes mean that according to federal classification authorities, the information was classified the very second it was originated, in this case, July 1, 2010. In the case of this July 1, 2010 document, Hillary's message is the only content in the entire document that has been redacted. This means that she was not the helpless recipient of classified information, but the originator. In other words, she deliberately created and intentionally disseminated classified information via an unsecured, unsanctioned private email server. In 2009, President Obama signed an executive order that U.S. officials who negligently disclose classified information to unauthorized individuals are subject to any and all federal sanctions provided for by law. I'm still reporting from Washington. Good day.
Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Wake Up Call on this Friday, the 4th of September, 2015. I am Richard Martin, and I'm coming to you all the way from Penang. May I start by suggesting that if any of you haven't had a chance to hear the comments by some of our recent participants to our very first Destination Penang seminar, you will find them right below this broadcast in the Podbean archive, and I strongly suggest you listen to them. They are an eye-opener. I had no idea how Penang might resonate with Americans from all walks of life, but I was nothing short of stunned to see how everyone felt so much at ease with the seminar and the people they met. Everyone here has commented on how quickly everyone seemed to adapt. No question about it. Frankly, it succeeded beyond my wildest expectations. Well, one of the most firmly entrenched myths of American ideology is that the U.S. is a middle-class society, a land of opportunity, where anyone who works hard has the opportunity to achieve the standard of living which has made America the envy of the world. A common and spot-on rejoinder has been to remind us that America has always had a sizable class of permanently poor people, and that it is just factually false to say that those ready, willing, and able to work are on the path to middle-class status. But does this reply concede too much? Has there ever been a substantial middle class in America? Or has a poor working class been able to mask its condition by accessing an institution that has disguised a large portion of a poor working class as a middle class? The best place to start is with the history of the modern American middle class. Of course, not everyone can get rich, for roughly the same reason that not everyone can be very tall. but most of us are supposed to be able to enjoy the comforts that many Americans enjoyed after the Second World War and earlier in economically pubescent form during the Roaring Twenties. That decade was the first in history when any population enjoyed the comforts of a consumer society. The remarkable growth rates of that decade were driven entirely by Americans' purchases of automobiles, ranges, radios, phonographs, toasters, refrigerators, electric fans, and more. The whole world saw the miracle of the first genuine, non-professional middle class. These new luxuries were not restricted to the very rich, and doctors and lawyers. Wage workers were the majority consumers of these consumer durables. But during the Great Depression, many radical workers were the majority consumers, and leftists argued that the short-lived prosperity for white people of the 1920s was a fluke, a temporary aberration from capitalism's default condition, in which the working class was flat-out poor. Sure, the war ended the Depression, but if that was so, it was feared that once the war ended, the economy would revert to normal, with high unemployment and widespread poverty once again the order of the day. This was a major concern in the mid-40s of a great many economists of every political stripe. But after the historically unheard-of post-war expansion, with no major economic contractions, the Depression came to be dismissed as the outcome of silly mistakes. For example, the high interest rate policy of the Federal Reserve, the Friedman-Bernanke story, and the shameless shenanigans of profligate financiers. The post-war glory days, again for white people, came to be regarded as the new normal, the resumption and expansion of the middle-class society of the 1920s. The record was truly spectacular. On the income of one male breadwinner, very many families were able to afford a house, at least one automobile, a plethora of durable goods, higher education for the kids, medical expenses, and sufficient savings for mom's and dad's retirement. Hard work paid off in a wage supporting a standard of living hitherto unknown to any working class anywhere. Only in America. During a May appearance on Letterman, Obama stated that catechismal account of the myth of the middle class, referring to, quote-unquote, middle-class America's basic bargain, that if you work hard, you have a chance to get ahead. Those impressive benefits once available to the golden age single breadwinner household are typically held to demonstrate that the middle-class bargain has been a reality for the majority of American workers. To be sure, we're in a wee bit of a depression right now, but once that's fixed, the middle-class dream will once again be within the grasp of those willing to work hard. That was the message of the Obamination's Letterman stint. A rational and historically informed response to the legend of the middle class is that this alleged stratum of the 1920s and the Golden Age existed for a mere 34 years of American history. Before the 1920s, just about all working class people were poor. Since 1974, there have been 42 years of burgeoning inequality, underemployment, growing poverty, and steadily declining wages with no end in sight. The middle class was a departure from the historic norm of a materially insecure working class, the default position of industrial capitalism. That response, accurate as it is, harbours a deeper myth that disguises a virtually unremarked and scandalous feature of the history of the US working class, namely, that it has always been poor. There never was a middle class, not in the sense in which that concept is meant to pack the punch intended by capitalist apologetics. If that's so, the US has never been a rich country. The matter hinges on what is meant by middle class. This is no merely semantic question. The term is at the core of the justification of modern capitalism and connotes not merely a statistical income level, but is meant to convey the relation between one's willingness to earn a living, i.e. to work hard, and the possibility of achieving a desirable standard of living as a reward for one's work. The example I just cited, describing the benefits available to the one breadwinner family during the Golden Age, is meant to imply that those benefits are the just deserts of hard work. That was the clear intention of Obama's Letterman claim. The middle class gets what it deserves as a reward for its labor. But here's the truth, which may be very hard for some of you to digest, but it is a fact. The working class has never been able to achieve economic security on the basis of its wage. Being dutifully productive has never been sufficient to guarantee the worker a satisfying life. If working people are to enjoy the benefits once available to the single breadwinner, they must permit a portion of that hard-earned wage to be extracted from their income by creditors. More precisely, the benefits might be forthcoming. Remember, hard work is merely a necessary, not a sufficient condition of material security. But only if the worker is prepared to allow a reduction of future income by the creditor's extraction of interest from the paycheck to come. Reduced income purchases a higher standard of living. Sounds paradoxical, but it's not. That is what debt is about. Neither in the 1920s nor during the Golden Age did workers achieve security and the pleasures of capitalist consumerism as the just reward for their labour. Let's have a closer look at the fortunes of working people in the 1920s. The most striking feature of the condition of working people in the 20s is how closely it resembled the declining fortunes of the working class during the post-boom age of austerity. Inequality, not seen since before 1900, became conspicuous during the Roaring Twenties. 1928 was the year of peak 20th century inequality up to that time. 1929 delivered a historic financial crash. 2007 was the first year thereafter to match the inequality of 1928. 2008 gave us the greatest financial crisis ever. The connection between inequality and economic crisis is hard to miss. The consumption boom of the 20s went along with the century's greatest inequality. In 1919, the percentage shares of total income received by the top 1% and the top 5% stood, respectively, at 12.2% and 24.3%. In 1923, the shares had risen to 13.1% and 27.1%, and by 1929 to 18.9% and 33.5%. According to the prestigious Brookings Institution, in 1929, quote-unquote, 0.1% of the families at the top received practically as much as 42% of families at the bottom of the scale. All of the increases in real income in the 1920s went to upper income groups, and most of the rest merely held firm or lost ground. Extreme inequality followed mathematically from these features of the economy of the 1920s. Production soared, productivity and profits skyrocketed much faster than production, while wages remained stagnant. Sound familiar? History shows this to be the overripe capitalism's default position. The post-war period up to this day exhibits the same features. Do the 20s look like a golden age before the golden age? In the classic Brookings Institute study of income and poverty levels during the 1920s, America's capacity to consume, we learn that, quote, by 1929, 71% of American families earned incomes of under $2,500 a year, the level that the Bureau of Labor Statistics considered minimal to maintain an adequate standard of living for a family of four. 60% earned less than $2,000 a year, the amount determined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, sufficient to supply only basic necessities. End of quote. 50% had less than $1,700, and more than 20% had less than $1,000. Thus, nothing resembling a middle class existed in the 1920s. 60% of families earned less than what was required to provide only basic necessities. Half of all families made even less than that, and more than one in five earned less than half that required to provide basic necessities. Working Americans were poor. America was a poor country. The employment figure was equally grim. During the steep recession in the first years of the decade, unemployment among non-farm workers hit 19.5% in 1921 and 11.4% in 1922. In 1924, it rose from 4.1% to 8.3%, fell to 2.9% in 1926, and was back up to 6.9% in 1928. The years 1922 to 1926 were the period of fastest growth in production and profits before overinvestment and underconsumption slowed the rate of GDP and sales growth. Yet two of those boom years saw unemployment comparable to or exceeding 2015's official unemployment figures. Here we have yet another entry in the list of things you're not allowed to know. During the Roaring Twenties, the majority of Americans were poor, i.e., America was a poor country. And even the post-war golden age years, we shall see, do not evidence the existence of a middle-class society. Yet during both the 1920s and the Golden Age, America did not look like a poor country. Autos were everywhere, households were swimming in consumer durables, and home ownership was growing at a healthy clip. But appearances can be deceptive. Real poverty can be disguised, and the principled means of obscuring material insecurity when a middle class has appeared to exist has been the extension of credit to vast numbers of working households. During both the 1920s and the Golden Age, households accumulated mounting debt in order to achieve the middle class standard of living. Workers' wages needed a substantial supplement of financial speed to goose the buying power required for middle-class pleasures. That's not part of the myth of the middle class. In order for the standard story to pack the punch it wants to pack, one of two conditions must be met. Either, one, the wage of the breadwinner must be sufficient to enable the benefits touted in the single breadwinner story, or two, if the wage sometimes needs to be supplemented in order to enable middle-class status, the supplement must be chronic, not, in fact, the case. It must not be addictive, and it must not invariably be climaxing in crisis. Neither of these conditions was met in the 1920s or the Golden Age. How, then, was the consumer durables boom of 1929 to 1929 possible when wages barely rose and workers were poor? The buying spree was sustained by credit purchases, spending more than one earned. Demand out of wage income alone was insufficient to purchase what the economy was capable of turning out. Rising standards of living could not be maintained in the face of stagnant wages without the ability of consumers to mortgage future income. The 20s were the first instance of what was to become an abiding feature of American capitalism: the need for large-scale credit financing to sustain levels of consumption required to stave off macroeconomic retardation and persistent economic insecurity. The Hoover Commission report, a massive study of the economy of the 1920s, conducted by a large team of the country's most prominent economists, reported that, quote-unquote, "The most spectacular and the most novel development in the field of credit was the growth after 1920 of a variety of forms of consumers' borrowing. The amount of such credit was tremendously expanded, both absolutely and relatively, during the past decade. The proportion of total retail sales financed by credit increased from 10% in 1910 to 15% in 1927 to 50% in 1929. Over 85% of furniture, 80% of washing machines, and 75% of phonographs and radios, indeed most new consumer items, were purchased on time. A prime reason General Motors pulled ahead of Ford in car sales was that it enabled credit purchases through the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, GMAC. Credit was even used to buy clothes. Young, single working women often went into debt to keep up with the latest styles. By 1929, sales on installment approached $7 billion. Many more people bought these goods than would have had they to save the total price in cash before making the purchases. Credit pervaded the household economy and disguised low wages, as it would again in the post-war period. In Middletown, the landmark study of the industrial town Muncie, Indiana, in the years 1924 to 1925, Robert and Helen Lind note the pervasiveness of credit in the everyday lives of working people there. Quote, "Today, Middletown lives by a credit economy that is available in some form to nearly every family in the community. The rise and spread of the dollar down and not so much per plan extends credit for virtually everything. Homes, $200 overstuffed living room suites, electric washing machines, automobiles, fur coats, diamond rings, to persons of whom frequently little is known as to their intention or ability to pay." End of quote. In the sense of the term required by apologists who use it, there has never been an American middle class. During both the 1920s and the post-war period, household prosperity and overall economic growth depended on increasing dosages of debt in order to maintain an increasing standard of living and the appearance of middle-class security. Wages, though, did not increase as rapidly as did debt growth. In fact, wages remained flat throughout the 1920s. So debt grew to the point at which it could not be paid. Borrowing and purchasing power then declined in 1926. Underconsumption became conspicuous as excess inventories and capacity built up. Crisis ensued. It is often claimed that the sustained growth of the post-war golden age was possible only because labor unions were able to keep wages rising in step with productivity gains. But this historic achievement was a necessary, not a sufficient, condition of the increase in purchasing power necessary to produce the middle-class standard of living of the golden age, for white people, mind you. It is a measure of just how high wages must be in order fully to avert mass unemployment and growing inequality that increasing injections of household or consumer debt were required to provide the requisite purchasing power. This was as true during the Golden Age as it was in the 1920s. Capital again worked its magic. Another underconsumption crisis was averted, even as wages were kept below what was needed to avert crisis. This was accomplished by initiating a bubble in consumption, encouraging households to augment their buying power by taking on increasing burdens of debt. In 1946, the ratio of household debt to disposable income stood at about 24%. By 1950, it had risen to 38%. By 1955, to 53%, by 1960 to 62%, and by 1965 to 72%. The ratio fluctuated from 1966 to 1978, but the stagnation of real wages, which began in 1973, pressured households further to increase their debt burden in order to maintain existing living standards, pushing the ratio of debt to disposable income to 77% by 1979. And keep in mind that accumulating debt was necessary not merely to purchase more toys, but to meet rising housing, healthcare, education, and childcare costs. With prohibitive healthcare costs the leading cause of personal bankruptcy, debt was necessary for all but the wealthy to stay out of poverty. By the mid-1980s, with neoliberalism in full swing and wages stagnating, the ratio began a steady ascent from 80% in 1985 to 88% in 1990, to 95% in 1995, to over 100% in 2000, to 138% in 2007. As debt rose relative to workers' income, households' margin of security against insolvency began to erode. The ratio of personal saving to disposable income under neoliberalism began a steady decline, falling from 11% in 1983 to 2.3% in 1999. The debt bubble that became unmistakable in the 1990s was to be far greater than the bubble of the 1920s. The financial system by now was capable of far more fraud and treachery than was possible in the 1920s, thanks largely to deregulation and derivatives. But what gets to the heart of capitalism is the overall similarity of the 1920s and the post-war periods. During each period, wages failed to be high enough to purchase the requisites of a decent, much less a rising, standard of living without an unsustainable and therefore crisis-generating household debt bubble. In neither period was hard work and the corresponding wage sufficient to avert sub-middle-class status. The Golden Age, like the 1920s, was an age of a debt-junkie nation of poor workers. The much-touted vanishing middle class is rooted in time-released conditions fully in place during the Golden Age. Poor workers were allowed to mask their economic insecurity with debt-financed widgets permitted by their social and economic masters on the condition that they agree in exchange to turn over a significant portion of their future earnings to those masters, and at a time when they could least afford it. I'd call those workers poor from the get-go. In the absence of organized resistance, the current age of rising inequality, low wages, high unemployment, and increasing economic precariousness will persist indefinitely. If most Americans have always been poor in the sense that counts, how shall we describe the condition of working people in the age of secular stagnation? Repressed. For sure. Persistent and hopeless austerity will generate social dislocation on a disturbing scale. Rising crime and suicide rates, domestic violence and psychological depression. I think of these as expressions of unorganized resistance. Oppressive conditions are naturally resisted in one form or another. The form taken depends on the existence and scope of savvy agents of political resistance. In any case, the state is preparing for what it fears will be a significant outburst of mass recalcitrance. The infrastructure of a police state is in place. State repression apparently must be practiced, rehearsed, in preparation for fully fledged assault. The experimental subjects have thus far been largely black people, but that's just the dress rehearsal. Only an organized, active left with a mass base can avert what's in the wings. It doesn't look good, and it is a major reason why you need to leave the country. The only question remaining is whether you will pay heed. As they say, I can lead you to the water.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's wake-up call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Well, just to show it's not only US analysts that don't have a clue, their Goldman Sachs brethren in China are no better. On July the 7th, Goldman's China equity strategist gave the all-clear signal right after the preceding 20-day $3.5 trillion meltdown of the China stock market. Completely ignoring the fact that China's newly affluent classes have opened 287 million trading accounts, mostly in recent months and mostly amounting to highly margined table stakes at its red chip casinos, Goldman saw nothing but blue skies ahead. Quote, Qinghe Lao, the bank's China strategist in Hong Kong, predicts the large cap CSI 300 index will rally 27% from Tuesday's close over the next 12 months as government support measures boost investor confidence and monetary easing spurs economic growth. Leveraged positions aren't big enough to trigger a market collapse, and valuations have room to climb. End of quote. Goldman Sachs is sticking with its optimistic forecast in the face of record foreign outflows, the biggest ever sell-off by Chinese margin traders, and a chorus of bubble warnings from international peers. The call hinges on the success of unprecedented government efforts to revive confidence among individual investors who watched equity values tumble by $3.2 trillion over the past 3 weeks. "It's not in a bubble yet," Lau said in an interview. "China's government has a lot of tools to support the market." Well, not exactly. The Shanghai Composite is down 21% since then, and a staggering 43% from the levels attained in late March. That amounts to a $4 trillion wealth implosion in less than 100 trading days. Well, if you've ever picked up a copy of The Economist magazine, you've probably heard of the Big Mac Index. This is an interesting tool where a bunch of reporters from around the world are forced to go into McDonald's and find out the price of a Big Mac in local currency. In Santiago, Chile, for example, a Big Mac runs 2,100 Chilean pesos, which is around $3. Meanwhile, the average price for a Big Mac in the United States is $4.79. This suggests that the US dollar is substantially overvalued against the Chilean peso. It's the same story across most of the world. In Russia, a Big Mac costs 107 rubles, which is just over $1.50. The reason The Economist uses the Big Mac is because it's basically the same product no matter where you go in the world. There are some subtle differences, but McDonald's generally serves the same pink foam disguised as beef wherever you go. So in theory, it should all cost the same. When a Big Mac is too cheap or too expensive, this suggests that the currency is either undervalued or overvalued against the US dollar. Now, I'd like to add a new way of comparing currencies. Airfare. If you travel round the world, you can buy what are known as round-the-world tickets, RTW. RTW tickets are issued by airline alliances like Oneworld or Star Alliance, and they're typically very cost-effective. RTW is just like it sounds. You fly, for example, from London to Chicago to Shanghai to Dubai and back to London, all for one special fare. It's a cheap, easy way to see the world. But I'll let you in on a little secret here. The price of an RTW ticket varies dramatically depending on the city where you start. As an example, here's a One World or RTW ticket with the following itinerary: Los Angeles, Sydney, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Johannesburg, London, Los Angeles. Six different cities around the world on five continents. Now, if you start and stop that itinerary in Los Angeles, the price for a business class ticket is $14,164.60. That's not a bad price for a business class experience. But if we experiment a little bit, something interesting happens. Starting and stopping the journey in Los Angeles means that One World prices my ticket in US dollars. But it's also possible to fly the same route by shifting the cities. For example, instead of starting and stopping in LA, you can start and stop in Sydney. So the route becomes Sydney, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Johannesburg, London, Los Angeles, Sydney. It's the same flight to the same six cities, you just start and stop in a different place. Here's what's crazy. If you start and stop in Sydney instead, the price changes. Now, instead of $14,164.60, it's $15,272 Australian dollars, which is about $10,900 US. So the same six flights now cost you 23% less. Note that the RTW ticket is always priced in the local currency of the city where you start. And unlike the Big Mac Index, where the results are skewed by the costs of ingredients, property and labour, here you're comparing the exact same product. Here's the same with each city on the list. And the most incredible difference came starting and stopping the trip in Johannesburg. Johannesburg, London, Los Angeles, Sydney, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Johannesburg. Flying to the exact same cities, the price is now 81,390 South African rand. Based on current exchange rates, this is just barely over $6,000. In other words, you pay over $14,000 by starting and stopping in LA and just $6,000 to start and stop in South Africa, even though you're visiting the exact same six cities on the exact same flights in the exact same business class cabin. What's even more amazing that if you do the exact same itinerary from LA in economy class, the price is $7,545. So that means that if someone flies from LA, they'll pay more to fly in coach than someone starting in Johannesburg pays to fly in business. Clearly, you'd be better off buying a separate ticket to South Africa and beginning your round-the-world journey from there. Or you could spend about $200 and get a ticket to Vancouver and start an RTW from Vancouver, which costs about $10,000 in business class and gives you a $4,000 savings. Oh, there's my travel agency attempt at satisfying the wake-up call, ladies and gentlemen. Do as you please. Well, downside risks to the global economy have risen, and a combination of threats, including slower growth in China and rising market volatility, could severely cut the outlook, International Monetary Fund staff warned on Wednesday. A note prepared by IMF staff for a meeting of group of 20 finance officials describes a cocktail of potentially dangerous risks, ranging from a stronger US dollar to depreciating currencies in emerging markets, falling commodity prices, and weaker capital inflows. The note was prepared for the G20 meeting in Ankara, Turkey, on Friday and Saturday, and I quote, "Risks are tilted to the downside, and a simultaneous realization of some of these risks would imply a much weaker outlook. The recent sharp equity market corrections should not discourage the authorities from continuing with reforms to give market mechanisms a more decisive role in the economy, eliminate distortions, and strengthen institutions. The need for policies to boost growth among G20 nations has become more urgent in the last 6 months, and accommodative monetary policy in advanced economies is, quote, essential. End of quote. The IMF in July lowered its global growth forecast for 2015 to 3.3%, and forecast growth in China, where a currency devaluation and growth concerns have fanned sharp moves or global financial markets, would slow to 6.8%. Well, until very recently, large exposure to China was seen as an advantage, a toehold in the market of the future. Now it's seen as a risk, and some of the world's most advanced companies seem to be on the losing side of a huge bet. Banks in particular have huge exposure to China. The June 2015 quarterly review by the BIS indicates that, in absolute terms, China was the eighth largest borrower worldwide, with cross-border claims on its residents totaling $1 trillion. To put that in perspective, bank claims on Greece have never exceeded about $300 billion. The absolute numbers for big foreign banking systems exposure to China are starker. UK banks' $198 billion in Chinese assets at the end of last year looks particularly threatening, especially given that HSBC and Standard Chartered both derive a significant portion of their revenue from China. The danger to banks is far more real and potentially costly than the one facing tech and food companies. Obviously, China isn't going through a Greek-style meltdown. But there are visible warning signs for banks, including the recent stock market collapse, the ineffectual measures of the Chinese government undertook to arrest it, and the loss of $315 billion in international reserves in the 12 months to July 2015. Financial institutions and countries that have become dependent on exports to China are first in line to suffer adverse consequences. Well, like the characters in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, the world awaits the return of wealth and prosperity. But the global economy may be entering a period of stagnation. Over the last 35 years, the economic growth necessary to increase living standards, increase wealth, and manage growing inequality has been based increasingly on rising borrowings and financial rather than real engineering. There was reliance on debt-driven consumption. It resulted in global trade and investment imbalances, such as that between China and the US or Germany and the rest of Europe. Everybody conspires to ignore the underlying problem, cover it up, or devise deferral strategies to kick the can down the road. Citizens demanded and governments allowed a build-up of retirement of healthcare entitlements, as well as public services for those who maintained office. The commitments were rarely fully funded by taxes or other provisions. The 2008 financial crisis was a warning of the unstable nature of these arrangements. But there has been no meaningful change. Since 2007, global debt has grown by $57 trillion, or 17% of the world's gross domestic product. In many countries, debt has reached unsustainable levels, and it's unclear how or when it is to be reduced without defaults that would wipe out large amounts of savings. Imbalances remain. Entitlement reform has proved politically difficult. Financial institutions and activity dominate many economies. The official policy is extend and pretend, whereby everybody conspires to ignore the underlying problem, cover it up, or devise deferral strategies to kick the can down the road. the assumption was that government spending, lower interest rates, and supplying abundant cash to the money markets would create growth. While the measures did stabilize the economy, they did not lead to a full recovery. Instead, they set off dangerous asset price bubbles in shares, bonds, real estate, and even fine arts and collectibles. Economic problems are now compounded by lower population growth and aging populations, slower increases in productivity and innovation, looming shortages of critical resources such as water, food, and energy, together with extreme weather conditions. Slower growth in international trade and capital flows is another retardant. Emerging markets such as China that have benefited from and recently supported growth are slowing. Rising inequality affects economic activity. For most people, the effect of these problems is unemployment, reduced job security, the de-skilling of many professions, and stagnant incomes. Home ownership is increasingly out of reach for many. Retirement may become a luxury, but for all but a few, reflecting increasing active difficulty in building sufficient savings. In effect, living standards will decline. Future generations will bear the bulk of the cost as they are left to tackle the unresolved problems of their forebears. Governments are unwilling to tell the truth about the magnitude of economic problems, the lack of solutions, and possible corrective actions to the electorate. Politicians have taken regard of historian Simon Sharma's comment that no one ever won an election by telling voters it had come to the end of its quote-unquote providential allotment of inexhaustible plenty. The official policy articulated in a moment of unusual candour by Jean-Claude Juncker, the head current of the European Commission, was that when the situation becomes serious, it is simply necessary to lie. Ordinary people are complicit, refusing to acknowledge that maybe you cannot have it all. They sense that the ultimate cost of the inevitable adjustments will be large. It is not simply the threat of economic hardship. It is fear of a loss of dignity and pride. It is a pervasive sense of powerlessness. The political and social response is likely to be volatile. It was the fear and disaffection of the middle class, which had lost its savings in the events of the Great Depression, that gave rise to totalitarianism. For the moment, to paraphrase Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the permanent lie has become the only safe form of existence. But the world cannot indefinitely postpone dealing decisively with the economic resource management and the social and political challenges we face. Well, I'm sure you've heard about China is censoring regular threatening sanctions for saying things like the stock market collapsed or there has been panic in the markets today. Well, did you know that US universities are not exactly unversed in the art? The magazine Campus Reform reports that, quote unquote, professors threaten bad grades for saying oppressive words. Multiple professors at Washington State University have explicitly told students their grades will suffer if they use terms such as illegal alien, male, and female, or if they fail to defer to non-white students. According to the syllabus for Selina Lester Brycas Women and Popular Culture class, students risk a falling grade if they use any common descriptors that Brycas considers oppressive and hateful language. Much like in Selina Brycas's classroom, students taking Professor Rebecca Fowler's Introduction to Comparative Ethnic Studies course will see their grades suffer if they use the term illegal alien in their assigned writing. According to her syllabus, students will lose 1 point every time they use the words illegal alien or illegals rather than the preferred terms of undocumented migrants or immigrants or persons. White students in Professor John Streamus's Introduction to Multicultural Literature class are expected to defer to non-white students, among other community guidelines. If they, quote-unquote, want to do well in this class, Streamus previously generated controversy by calling a student a white shitbag and declared that WSU would stand for White Supremacist University. It is notable that one of the syllabus provisions warns, quote-unquote, the subject material of this class is sensitive and controversial. Strive to keep an open mind. How are students supposed to approach these sensitive and controversial materials at all, let alone to keep an open mind, if they have to fear that a misconstrued statement or one that unreasonably offends a classmate will lead to a grade reduction or even removal from class? In China, use of banned words and phrases or even an analytical report that says a company is struggling will land you in prison or worse. At Washington State University, use of politically incorrect terms will simply affect your grade. Moreover, students have the upfront option not to take inane classes in the first place. Rest assured, classes in multicultural literature and women and popular culture are not a likely foundation for a well-paying job. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can see very clearly how this kind of thing, innocuous though it may seem, with all the excuses given for how you can opt out and avoid it, how this is the beginning germinating seed of a process which will end you up in a situation not unlike that which prevails in China today. Like all hurricanes which start with a butterfly's perhaps fluttering its wings in West Africa, these kinds of trends have to start somewhere. And that is the danger that I foresee coming down the pike in all different areas of American life in the coming years. It's going to happen, and that is why I suggest that you find an alternative place to live. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end, as always, of a show, and it remains for me to wish you an excellent Memorial Day weekend ahead. I hope all goes well. The weather is fine. The hurricanes stay away, and the earthquakes and all the other unpleasant factors of life as we know it. And I will be back on Monday, as always, Memorial Day, with another edition of The Wake Up Call. So, until then, take care of yourselves. This is Richard Martin wishing you a great weekend. Bye-bye.
And there you have it. You decide.